are not necessarily those of IRN, its advertisers, or affiliates.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming at you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And you have to understand that America was really the culmination of all the concepts, you know, of Western civilization, beginning, you know, with Plato and Aristotle, and then carrying these ideas through the Dark Ages, through the Christian era, the Dark Ages, the time when, of course, the King of England signed the Magna Carta, and then the evolution of laws in England, and then the foundation of America. And America was different because we were the first nation in all time where we acknowledged that freedom did not come from government but came from God, and yet we were not going to establish a theocracy with somebody saying, well, this is what God said and this is what you're going to do, because that's what things had always been before. We'd always had a king who got his right to rule from the church, and a church that got its right to exploit the public from the king. And America, it was entirely different. We were going to establish a government where the power of the central authority was limited so the people could be free. And, of course, the whole idea was that if you had moral people, you could have a limited government. And so if the whole concept was that if you didn't have a moral people, you were going to have basically have an authoritarian system. And so what you wanted was a nation where people would be ruled individually by God, but not using God as the justification for the federal laws over our lives. The whole idea was to restrict the power of government over the lives of the people so men could be free. And then at the state level, you would deal with matters of life, liberty, and property, but never at the federal level. Because our founding fathers recognized that liberty and limited government were synonymous, and tyranny and total government are synonymous, but people don't understand there are people with a different worldview. There are people who want power, and they want to use the power of the United States, military and financial, to bring about a world dictatorship under their control and under the control of the God that they worship, because they want not only a new world order, they want a new world religion. And these people have sworn to uphold our Constitution and that have systematically ignored it. But even worse, the forces that work behind the scenes have made certain that this is never taught in schools. It's not taught in our law schools. It's not taught in our seminaries. It's not taught in our universities. And most Americans don't understand our Constitution, which is why we have with us this evening Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution, who with a small group of people is working all across America to reintroduce a novel idea. We have a Constitution that is the framework of our society. It is the foundation of our freedom. Isn't it strange that there's only one presidential candidate who ever talks about the Constitution and getting back to constitutional law? I wonder why that is and why the media totally ignores his candidacy. Well, with that as a background, Pastor David Whitney, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Oh, it's a blessing, Dr. Stan, to be on your show. And you were mentioning law schools and what's taught in law schools. Michael and I had the opportunity this week to sit down with the president of a local university in Maryland that has a law school, and the dean of that law school, and kind of urge them to teach the original view of law and government. That is William Blackstone and his expressions and his commentaries on the laws of England. And they were not very interested in that whole idea. It's not part of their agenda. They have a very different agenda, as you said, and therefore they're training up people who are trained in what we would call unlaw. Law that violates the supreme law of the universe, which is God's law, as our founders referred to it as the laws of nature, and nature's God.
Well, I think it's so vitally important that since we're not going to be able to depend on the educational establishment, or certainly our own political leaders, because after all, what they really want is power, and of course, if we were adhered to the Constitution, most of them would not have the power that they have, nor the wonderful perks or the profits that they're making as they, of course, rule over us common folks. Well, go ahead, David.
Well, we have been looking at the amendments to the Constitution over the past several months and looking at the subsequent amendments, particularly to the Bill of Rights, and we've said several times along the way that the Bill of Rights are a key essential element in restricting the federal government to a very small, defined playing field. I was just reading Federalist Paper 45, which is one of the very important ones, because it describes there that the design our founders had in mind, the design that they were structuring our government to be, is that the federal government would have very few and very defined and very limited powers, but that the states would have wide-ranging powers and nearly unlimited powers, particularly in relationship to life, liberty, and property of the citizens. That in terms of a government interaction with its people, people would very, very rarely interact with the federal government and very frequently with their state government. And the federal government would handle things that a state government could not, such as going to war or making treaties with foreign nations or dealing with tariffs and import, those sort of issues. That would be the job that the federal government would deal with, very small and unobtrusive type of activity, where the large and powerful structure would be the state government. Well, as we mentioned, the 17th Amendment damaged that structure extremely and by placing the senators in the popular election, which meant the most money that could purchase one of these senators would be what would happen rather than the state legislators electing and appointing the senators who would be answerable directly to them. So as we're looking at the subsequent amendments to the Bill of Rights, we're finding that many of them, not all, but many of them actually were undoing the structure established by our founders. And therefore, I think some of them should be repealed. And we have a precedent for that because the 21st Amendment, ratified in 1933, repealed the 18th Amendment, which was the amendment to prohibit alcohol in our land. It was a bad idea to begin with, and it's something the federal government should never have been involved with. But we have a precedent with the 21st Amendment that any amendment other than the Bill of Rights is absolutely essential to our freedom and our structure of government to protect us from a tyrannical government. Other than the Bill of Rights, any of the subsequent 17 amendments could be repealed, could be taken away by a subsequent amendment. And we've been talking about the last time, I believe, we left off at the 23rd Amendment that the District of Columbia received in 1961.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought right there, David. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney. And he's certainly talking about the 22nd, 23rd Amendments to the Constitution, pointing out that certainly any one of the amendments could be certainly withdrawn, could be removed, as we did with the amendment which allowed prohibition. And it was felt it was a bad idea. And so that amendment was simply withdrawn by a subsequent amendment to the Constitution. But what people don't understand is that the current administration has repealed the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment and is in the process of repealing the entire concept of the Bill of Rights, because the people who control the current administration, and it doesn't matter whether they're Republicans or Democrats, I mean, both political parties are culprits in this, really believe in an all-powerful central authority that can regulate us from the cradle to the grave, can control our property. And in the name of fighting the wicked Osama bin Laden, who the president, remember, had promised to get dead or alive and has never tried to get him dead or alive, in fact, we have to have an enemy. If we didn't have an enemy, would the people be willing to give up their freedom? After all, we're told we're fighting terrorism, and yet we're financing Saudi Arabia that's financing the whole worldwide terrorist movement between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, both of which are being firmly backed by our own government. We're backing the people who are certainly backing the Taliban in Afghanistan that are killing our boys, and backing Al-Qaeda in Iraq who are killing our boys, and most of the money from that is coming from our good friends in Saudi Arabia, but they promise one of these days they're going to stop. We've only been at war for 4 years over there and 6 years in Afghanistan, but One of these days, they're going to get around to stop funding the people who are killing the American boys, and they keep pointing to Iran, but it is really, of course, the people in Saudi Arabia and in Pakistan who are funding the world terrorist movement. Now, of course, Pastor David Whitney then is talking about the amendments to the Constitution. Go right ahead, David.
Well, the 23rd Amendment gave the District of Columbia electors in the presidential election. If you may recall how the president is elected in our country, it's by the Electoral College. That is, when you cast a vote for president, you're really casting a vote for an elector from your state who's going to represent you and ultimately cast a vote for who will become president. Well, the District of Columbia was designed by our founders to be a politically free zone in terms of local politics having any impact upon Congress as it gathered in session. And so the territory there of District of Columbia was designed not to have any voting for anyone on a federal level, so that they would not vote for the president or for senators or for congressmen.
And I think one reason why they didn't want them to have a vote was because they knew that they would tend to vote for the politician who had promised to give them the most, and they were federal employees.
Exactly.
Federal employees lived in the District of Columbia. Well, of course, if you really want to give the federal employees the right to vote for the politicians who have raised their salaries and give them a higher pension and give them more health care, I mean, that's the worst thing you could possibly do, is let people vote themselves into the public treasury, and that is why our founding fathers, in their wisdom, did not want the people of the District of Columbia, who mostly would be federal employees and government employees, to be able to have a vote, to be able to use their power and their voting power to elect officials who would give them more. That's a story as old as time.
That's right. And so this really was, again, a violation of that basic wisdom and structure that our founders established. If you wanted a right to vote, then just move out of Washington, D.C. Live outside the district. Today, if you look at the license plate, and I was just down there today speaking with some folks, you see the license plate of Washington, D.C. says taxation without representation. They're still pushing for more than just this 23rd Amendment, where they have electors that they vote for president. They're pushing for having actual congressmen and senators representing them, which is, again, just an egregious problem if that was ever granted to them. We pray that it won't be because, again, as you said, these people are going to be voting for the pay increases that take from the rest of the country and feed their pockets. Well, it was 3 years later, in 1964, that the 24th Amendment was ratified, and this is the amendment eliminating poll taxes. Many states had a small tax that was charged in order to vote, $1 or $2 and so on, and this was used to cover the cost of the election. So rather than taxing the people in order to pay for the election, they would say those who are voting should pay for the actual mechanism by which voting took place. And sometimes there would be a little bit of a surplus that a state might use for other purposes than actually the election as it was required. And because this was sometimes used, and again, there was very minor exceptions in terms of what took place, but sometimes it was used to deny people the right to vote. There was this big hue and cry, and this was during the civil rights era, of course, you remember, and this poll tax amendment actually eliminated that power that the state had to determine how it was going to conduct its election. We've talked about this principle before, and it's very important to remember that whenever the federal government takes power, it's taking power from the state government. And so the state governments up to this point in time had a power to determine how they were going to structure their election, how they were going to do that, and how the costs for that election were going to be managed. And the federal government here comes along and says, no, we're going to dictate to you, the states, exactly how you do this and what you can do and what you cannot do. Again, we have the federal government taking a power that is not appropriately theirs. And so those who voted in for the ratification of this amendment, again, they misunderstood the kind of structure that our founders established, where the states would have wide-ranging powers and the federal government very limited and very restricted powers. Well, it was just a few years later, in 1967, that the 25th Amendment was ratified, and this dealt with presidential succession. You know, if the president were to die, if the vice president were to die or be incapacitated, then who would actually take their role until the next election was held? And we've dealt with that before when we've talked about the executive branch, so we won't go into a great deal of detail there. But basically, the 25th Amendment just rearranged who, in order of departments that were part of the president's cabinet, who would be in line after the vice president. And it would make sense to make the changes made there in the 25th Amendment in terms of handling it, both president and vice president were incapacitated. So I think the 25th Amendment is a good amendment, one of the few that should be retained. Well, it was just a few years later after that, 1971, that the 26th Amendment was ratified, and this dealt with the 18-year-old vote. And basically, the 26th Amendment says the right to vote may not be denied on the basis of age for anyone who's over 18. And so this doesn't prevent a state from setting the voting age lower than 18. I mean, they could say 16 or something if they chose to, but they could not set it any higher than 18.
And, of course, I think that was a terrible, terrible thing. And they justified this during the Vietnam era, saying, if a young man is old enough to die for his country, he certainly ought to be able to vote. And, of course, the thing is that we should not be sending our young men overseas to die in a no-win war, as we did in Vietnam. But they used the emotional appeal of Vietnam and saying, if we're going to send our boys over there, they ought to be able to vote. Well, they shouldn't have been sent over there in the first place. This was an aggressive war. It was a war that was never fought to win. We financed the Russians, who financed the North Vietnamese, who financed the Viet Cong, who killed our boys, all during that war. And anybody who doubts that would be glad to provide a copy of my newsletter, where we simply quote from Professor Sutton's talk to the Republican National Committee back in 1972, pointing out we were financing the people who were financing the Viet Cong, who were killing our boys. It was a war we never fought to try to win. And to use that injustice of Vietnam to justify giving the vote to 18 years old, the average 18-year-old doesn't understand what the world is all about. And I think that people ought to be much older before they're allowed to vote. Myself, probably, if it were up to me, I'd say you ought to be at least 23 or 24. But go ahead, David.
Well, again, here we have an issue where the state is being deprived of a very important power determining who in that state will have the power to vote, and it's being placed in the hands of the federal government to dictate to the states who they must allow to vote. And again, we have this violation of the basic structure of the idea that we don't want the federal government to gain too much power. We want to keep the federal government's powers very limited and very restricted, because the federal government has the potential to become a very dangerous monopoly power, where the state governments never would become monopoly governments because they have the competition of other states.
You don't like what's going on in your state, you pick up and move to another.
That's right. You didn't like the laws in your state, you could change them or move. So the states always have to be competing for citizens, competing in setting laws that are going to be more attractive than other states. And this issue of what age a person should vote at should be at the state level and not at the national level, not the federal government making this decision. But this actually brings up an even wider issue, because today voting is increasingly seen as a universal right. That means if you're a breathing human being, you have the right to vote, is what the kind of philosophy that is often accepted today, rather than seeing, no, voting really is a means of protecting your God-given rights, the God-given rights of all the citizens, and voting is actually a privilege to be exercised only by those who can vote responsibly. That's the kind of message our founders very clearly communicated about the precious franchise of voting. Samuel Adams, often called the father of the American War for Independence, stated it so clearly that you're going to be held accountable not only by your country, but by God Almighty for that vote that you cast at the ballot box.
And, of course, unfortunately, throughout history, men have voted themselves into slavery, And that is, of course, what our founding fathers didn't want to happen. Too bad. Most of our Americans don't understand what's really happening. All right, David, pick the story up.
Well, when we consider really the philosophy our founders had, it was to protect God-given rights that government was instituted among men. Therefore,
gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Tierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Could simply pull out, and this was the understanding. The United States was created not by the people. It was created by the states, and the states created the government, and the federal government was never to regulate or interfere in any way with the states. In fact, that's why the United States senators were not elected by the people. They were elected by the state legislatures, and they were to represent the states, the rights of the states, to limit the power of the federal government. And how far we've gotten away from that, to the point that most people don't even understand the significance of the 17th Amendment, which was, of course, to change the structure of our society so that we could have not senators who would represent the interests of the states and the people, but we would have the finest senators that money could buy, and when it costs you $50 or $60 million to become a United States senator, the people who put up the money, of course, call the tune. Go right ahead, David.
Well, I was recalling what took place when President Lincoln asked Robert E. Lee to lead the Union Army, the Northern Army, and he basically refused because he said, "I cannot fight against my country." And by that, he was not referring to the United States. He was referring to Virginia. Virginia was his country, and he expressed a sentiment that was held all over the states at that time, that the state was my country. And we were in a confederacy, as you describe, a loose association with the other states for things that we cannot do alone, that must be done together. But other than that, the state was sovereign. The state had enormous powers, and that really was what the war between the states was all about, destroying that kind of state sovereignty and subjugating the states increasingly to federal control, to a point today where the states are, well, mere political subdivisions of the federal government, and have very little power, very little control over what is happening even within the borders of their own states, to the point where here with the 26th Amendment they're told you must allow every 18-year-old to vote. And a state might say, wait a minute, that's not a wise thing. We don't allow 18-year-olds to drink. Why should we allow them? You know, there's many other reasons why an 18-year-old may not be trusted. I really think the essential way in which you could guard the voting process would be to require everyone who is granted the right to vote, the privilege of voting, that they take a course teaching what we're teaching here at Institute on the Constitution. They take a course that gives them a clear understanding of our founders' view of law and government and a working knowledge of the Constitution, the Declaration, the Bill of Rights. And furthermore, you make them swear an oath that they will not just support and defend the Constitution, but obey the Constitution, that they will only vote for those who are going to obey the Constitution. So if we raise the standard as to who is permitted to vote to only those who are going to preserve the original design of our system of government, then we could return and bring us back to that design, because you have, like you mentioned earlier, people who are going to benefit by filling their own paycheck in how they vote. They're going to vote in that direction. And those are people who should never be given the power to vote, because we know what they will vote for is a destruction of our God-given rights, which is a violation of the very purpose for which governments are instituted among men in the first place. So I think this 26th Amendment was a bad idea in 1971, and would be one that we would do well to repeal, along with a number of others I'll mention in a few moments.
But I think, go back to 1971, everybody was unhappy with the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, somehow you sort of felt better when, see, now if we just had the 18-year-old votes, maybe we could do something to stop the war. People don't understand. These wars, of course, are created by a small clique. We went into Vietnam as a great diversion, so that we could bring socialism to America. That was the purpose, that was the objective, that, and of course, to kill as many people as we did. We killed a million South Vietnamese. We killed 2 million North Vietnamese. What if we ever mentioned that? Why, of course, we don't want to mention that. We're concerned about the 58,000 American boys who died, and we should justify be concerned about that, but what about the million South Vietnamese and the 2 million North Vietnamese? Do they suffer any less when they've been wounded or crippled, or is their blood any less red than that of Americans? Understand we're being manipulated, ladies and gentlemen. We were manipulated into Vietnam. We're being manipulated, of course, into Iraq. And next, of course, into a war with the Muslim world. And lowering the voting age to 18 is not going to change that. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney, and go right ahead, David.
Well, moving on to the 27th Amendment, which is actually the last and most recently ratified amendment. It was ratified in 1993. We have a very interesting amendment that deals with congressional pay raises, and that states that no congressional pay increases will take effect until after the next election. And this is a very convenient thing, because then it gives the people an opportunity to vote out those lawmakers who gave themselves a pay increase. And we can, at the polls, express our disapproval of the pay increase, voting the lawmakers out of office. So it's a nice idea. It would be strengthened if we could actually undo that pay increase and say, hey, we're going to vote and we're going to undo the pay increase because these people voted themselves a pay increase. And these senators and congressmen have one of the juiciest packages, better than most CEOs of even Fortune 500 companies in terms of their retirement benefits, in terms of their health care. I mean, they have they've given themselves the royal treatment in terms of their pay and their pay package and their benefits, far better than most, even the wealthiest of Americans. So this would be strengthened if we could actually undo the pay increase that they receive, or put them on the system that other Americans have to endure. And the interesting thing about this particular amendment, the 27th Amendment, was originally proposed way, way back as part of the Bill of Rights. Actually, there were 12 articles that were proposed as the Bill of Rights. Only 10 of those were ratified, the 10 that we currently know as our Bill of Rights. This one was one of the additional ones that was not originally ratified by three-quarters of the states. And so that's 203 years ago this was actually penned and actually submitted and ratified in a few states, but not enough states to actually become part of the Constitution as an amendment. So it wasn't really until the 1980s and even into the 1990s people became upset, and rightly so, upset with congressional pay increases. And seeing these people steal from us, basically, in an egregious fashion. And so an interest in this amendment was revived and renewed, and ultimately was ratified by the 38th state in 1993. Well, the interesting question this brings up, of course, is this amendment valid? After all, Article 5 in our Constitution, which details how an amendment process is conducted, how the Constitution does get amended. It doesn't specify in Article 5 how much time may elapse.
Hold that thought, David. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just talking about the 27th Amendment. We're going to get back to that just in a moment, but before we do, I want David to tell you a little bit about the Institute of the Constitution. I want him to tell you how you can get in touch with this organization, which is trying to teach people the fundamentals of our Constitution, which is really the fundamentals of our freedom, which, of course, if you understand that, you would understand that most of what the legislature is enacting and most of the legislation that President Bush signs is unconstitutional. And people have to understand that these people have all sworn an oath to uphold our Constitution and defend it from all enemies, foreign and domestic. And these are domestic enemies of our Constitution. They are enacting legislation that is unconstitutional, and they know it. But you see, they've come up with a different idea. We have a living, breathing Constitution. The law is whatever, of course, the legislators say it is, or what the courts say it is. And that's not true at all. The Constitution is fixed in stone. It can be amended, but they don't want to amend it, because you see, that would impede their move towards the police state. This all-powerful state will regulate everything that goes on in our society and take everything that we have in the name of course, protecting us from the wicked Osama bin Laden. David, how can people get in touch with your organization? What is the Institute of the Constitution?
We are an organization dedicated to training Americans in what the original idea, the original intent for the Constitution was, and our Declaration and Bill of Rights. And what we put together is what we call a host kit, because we don't expect any individual to teach the Constitution themselves, but there's 12 lectures by constitutional law professor John Eismo that go through the history, the Christian foundation, the Christian philosophy behind the form of government, and then gives people a working knowledge of the Declaration and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And this host kit has been used throughout all 50 states, and we're very encouraged as we see increasingly churches are recognizing that they need to train their people how to be Christian citizens, and a Christian cannot do his God calling, God-ordained duty as a Christian citizen in these United States unless he knows the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration. Unless he understands these things, he cannot go cast his vote with a true American point of view on law and government as to whether the person they're voting for will fulfill what the Constitution requires them to do. You can't do your job as a citizen unless you know these things. And so our host kit's designed to give people a very easy way in which they can train themselves and their family and take it to their church and help their church understand these things, and then even reach out to the non-Christians in the community. And we've actually seen some people come to faith in Christ. Not that the proclamation of the gospel is the essential element in this course, but elements of it are certainly sprinkled throughout, because our founders believe that all men are sinners and that except by the grace of Jesus Christ they cannot be redeemed and so on. But this course can be used to light a grass fire among Americans, and that grass fire ultimately resulting in restoring our republic. As you mentioned, the only reason these tyrants are currently getting away with violating the Constitution on a daily basis is most Americans are unaware that that's what's happening. They're unaware that the laws being made are really unlaw. That is, they're not law at all. Because if they're a violation of the supreme law of the land, our Constitution, they're not law. And so that much of what much of what is done in Washington, D.C. is criminal activity. They're stealing from the people, because every dollar they spend that they are not permitted to spend, for example, Department of Education being one thing, every dollar spent in the Department of Education is actually theft. It's theft from the people of America out of their pockets to spend it on something they do not have permission to spend it upon. And they get away with doing this because most Americans have no idea that that is what's taking place, because they don't know the standard. They don't know the Constitution. And so we encourage people to call us toll-free if they want to order by phone to get a host kit or to order some of our other materials. And our toll-free number at Institute on the Constitution is 866-730-9796. That toll-free number again for Institute on the Constitution is 866-730-9796. We encourage you also to go to our website, and we have a web store at iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. You'll also find many other resources you can purchase in that store, as well as a number of articles, an archive of our newsletters, and many other resources that can help you understand what you need to do to be an informed citizen who is able to evaluate. And particularly now, as the presidential election of 2008 is drawing near, you need to listen carefully in light of what the Constitution says with what these politicians are claiming or even promising, because most of them, I would say all but one, Ron Paul, most of the rest of them are promising already to violate their oath of office, which they take before Almighty God, to violate their oath of office even before they've taken office. And their campaign promises, they're promising to violate the Constitution, to break the supreme law of the land. And it's just amazing to think that because Americans don't know this document, they don't know the Constitution, that these liars and these thieves and these lawbreakers can get away with it. And Americans think, oh, it's great, I'm supporting this candidate and that candidate, and they have no standard by which to measure what is a good candidate and what is a terrible candidate. That is a candidate who is dangerous to your God-given liberties of life and liberty and property. So we encourage your listeners to get a host kit, begin with your own family and your own church family, and then expand to the community and take this message so that we can take our country back and we can restore this constitutional republic founded upon God's law and the principles of God's word.
All right, fine. Well, of course, our guest is Pastor David Whitney. If you're out in the audience and you have a question apropos to what we're talking about, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we were talking about the 27th Amendment, which, of course, means that the pay raise for the congressman that he has voted for will not go into effect until the next session of Congress. I thought that, David, and you may please correct me if I'm wrong, but that they'd gotten around this to some extent by saying that Congress was sort of going to automatically get a raise, and so basically, of course, the cost of living, something of that sort, they give themselves automatically a raise so they don't have to vote for it, so that their parishioners, of course, won't be angry, or the people, their constituents won't be angry. I mean, here we have a Congress, the rating, public approval of Congress is 11%. What does that tell you about America? If only 11% of our people really trust our congressmen, I mean, aren't we in real trouble as a nation? Can this nation survive? But the idea that they get the automatic raise, but I bet they don't get the 2.1% they give to the Social Security people. They probably give them a real raise, of course, which is reflecting inflation, which is probably close to 11% at the present time, and they're simply lying to us about the real raise. I'd love to know how much the congressman's pay raise goes up each year. What, of course, the Social Security recipients get a 1% or 2% raise. Go ahead.
That is absolutely true. So they basically, though, what they're doing is a violation of this principle established in the 27th Amendment, and therefore is an unconstitutional action to give themselves an automatic pay raise without having to be answerable to the electorate. Well, the interesting debate here is because 203 years transpired between the proposal of this amendment and its actual ratification in 1993. There's a little question here about, is this valid? The Fifth Article 5 doesn't specify a time limit, and early on in the history of our nation, including this particular amendment, there was no time limit put on the amendments that were proposed. They were just put out, but currently, of course, Congress, in passing any amendment and sending it to the states, will put a time limit, often 7 years. If you think back a few decades ago, you'll remember the Equal Rights Amendment proposed to basically say that men and women have equal rights, which is an unnecessary thing altogether. But anyway, that didn't succeed because the time expired before three-quarters of the states actually ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. And so currently, whenever Congress would have an amendment, there's a time limit put on that for the ratification process. But in this case, there was no time limit ever put when it was originally submitted 203 years after it was ratified. And it could be there would come a court challenge that a court might rule that since no time limit was set, well, the amendment's valid whenever it receives three-quarters of the state's ratification. Or the court might rule the opposite and say, well, in the absence of a specified time limit, the amendment must be ratified within a reasonable time, and they might conclude that 203 years is not a reasonable time. So we don't know what could happen if this was challenged in court, but currently the amendment was certified by the director of the U.S. Archives, and until a court says otherwise, it's considered part of the Constitution.
And of course, but it is really totally redundant,
yes,
since they're giving themselves an automatic pay raise. Isn't that nice? Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Mike, does he have a question for you?
Yes, I do. Back when Congress voted to give George Bush the power to invade Iraq, I think that there are a string of questions that must be asked and answered about that, such as, was Congress or our government in general denying the Constitution or subverting the Constitution or changing the workings of the government
All right, well,
in a way that's unconstitutional?
All right, let's get an answer to that. What about resolution that Congress passed that gave the president permission to invade Iraq? Don't we really need a declaration of war?
That's exactly right, because the structure of our Constitution says that Congress declares war. The president, as the chief, he is the one who executes the war, but he is not the one that decides to go to war. In fact, Congress, in issuing a declaration of war, can only fund that war for 2 years. They can provide for 2 years funding, and then they have to reauthorize that war. Basically, they kind of have to declare war again, or say the war that was declared is going to be funded for another 2 years. And again, that 2 years is a very important thing, because within that two-year window of time, all the congressmen are going to stand for re-election, so that the public, the citizens, basically can have a referendum on whether they want the war to continue or not by voting out the congressmen who voted for the war, and making their voice very, very strongly heard in Washington, D.C.
And, of course, what happened was the people overwhelmingly voted the Republicans out and voted the Democrats in to give them the majority in both the Senate and the House of Representatives. And then what did the Democrats do? They continued the same policy. So it was really an exercise in futility, but everybody felt really good because now we got rid of the wicked Republicans who had pushed the war, and we put in their place Democrats who said that they don't approve of the war, but they still vote to fund it, and they could cut it off tomorrow by withholding the funds, and they have no intention of doing that. Anything else, Mike?
Well, the grassroots Democrats also were so happy because they thought the new Congress was going to impeach Bush and Cheney, and they didn't lift a finger.
That's absolutely right. It's all showbiz.
But back to the thing about the presidency, it really just seems like they stabbed another spear through the heart of the Constitution by doing that, and they also transformed the powers of the executive branch in a way that's so far beyond what the framers of the Constitution ever intended.
All right, let's get Pastor Whitney's view of that. Would you agree with Mike that we've expanded the power of the federal government to that of really a dictator?
That's right, because the president has accumulated to himself enormous powers, particularly with executive orders, which I believe are essentially unconstitutional because they place a legislative power in the hand of the president. The president is never to legislate. He is to execute the laws that the legislature, the Congress, and the Senate actually pass. He's not to make up law on his own, just as the judges, the design was that the judges, as a separate branch, they don't make law. They apply the law to individual cases. And so what we have really is a breakdown of the three branches of government and the separation of powers between those three branches, with the executive acting like a legislature and the judiciary acting like a legislature and the legislature basically being completely not holding the other two branches of government within the boundaries that they're supposed to be within.
Yeah,
so
I think you're absolutely
right. We do have a breakdown of the entire system, and the American people, by and large, are ignorant of this and ignorant of these violations of the Constitution, so they think, sure, going to war, we did it legitimately. After all, the Congress gave the president permission to do that.
Yeah, that was, of course, because Saddam Hussein was about to use those weapons of mass destruction on us. Everybody knows. That's what the president promised, but then he did promise us to get Osama bin Laden dead or alive, too. Hey, thanks very much, Mike.
Okay,
let's go to Will calling from Missouri. Hi, Will.
Hello, Dr. Stan and Pastor Whitney. I've got a question for you. I've been to your website. I have looked at the information. I'm quite interested in conducting these programs. Two questions. Number one, can you give us an idea of what percentage of groups that begin the course on the Constitution actually finish that course nationwide? Have you gotten that kind of results yet anywhere?
The people that we're in contact with, in other words, people purchase a host kit, and then people tell us, and we try to keep a record of who starts the class. In other words, when somebody says our class is starting, we encourage people to give us that information so we can publish it on our website, that people across the country can look and say, oh, is there a class happening in my community or somewhere nearby? And of those people who do tell us that information, a high percentage, like 95% of them, actually complete the course. I have to admit, though, there's many other people who perhaps purchase a host kit and we don't hear back from them, so we don't know if they conducted the course, did they complete the course. we have found in our own experience that the people who start the course and come through the first lecture usually get excited about what they're going to learn, and they go the distance. That is, they complete all, usually we do it as a 12-session series. They usually complete all 12 sessions of the course.
What did he ask, Will?
So that was my second question then, as 12 sessions. Now, do you look at that to be like a three-month period, or are you looking at that as be a shorter time period? What would be more effective?
Depends on the people you have. Some people we've found want to do things in a rapid fashion, and so we've offered a six-week session. That is, each night of the 6 weeks, you're doing a double, you know, two lectures in that night, and instead of doing it over 12 weeks, some people find that they can make a commitment to 6 weeks much easier. And so in some circumstance, that works best. We've even done it over a weekend, which is very difficult to pack it all into a Friday through Sunday. But for some people, they want to get it all at once, and that's been effective as well.
Thank you.
It's really up to you, Will, how you want to do it. The important thing is for people to understand the miracle of our Constitution and dedicate themselves to trying to preserve it. Anything else, Will?
No, that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Will.
Will, I hope you will take this as a challenge and get that started there in Missouri.
I would love to. I think it would be very useful.
God bless. Bye-bye. Well, David, you have 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
What I'd like to do is just go back over some of the amendments and comment on those that I think should be repealed. We know that this precedent is set, of course, with the 18th Amendment being repealed, but I'd like to propose 10 other amendments that I think should be repealed. For example, the 11th Amendment, we talked about that basically grants the state a power that I don't think it should have, a power to enter into a contract with somebody that's not a citizen of that state and then go ahead and violate that contract and face no consequences. They can't be taken to the court of law to do that. And that's the 11th Amendment that should be done away with. The 13th Amendment, it abolished slavery. And you might say, well, that's a good thing. It should abolish slavery. But again, this is a decision that should be at the hands of the state and not the federal government tyrannically forcing the states into this position. Likewise, the 14th Amendment. 14th Amendment determining what due process in terms of life, liberty, and property, etc., would be forced upon the state. Again, this is not the job of the federal government to micromanage the states in many ways. And by the way, the 14th Amendment is usually, with the Supreme Court, the most often cited amendment in almost every Supreme Court case. The 14th Amendment is brought in, and the Supreme Court these days is targeting exclusively, not the federal government and how it should be restricted, but it's targeting state governments and how to shut down and reduce the powers of state governments, and usually that's through the 14th Amendment.
Well, don't you think, David, that instead of repealing the whole 14th Amendment, just simply clarify the 14th Amendment so that it would have what it was, the meaning was had when it was actually passed, rather than the misinterpretation by our courts, who are using the 14th Amendment to apply the limitations on the federal government to the state government and resulting in moral anarchy.
That is certainly true, that the original intent of the 14th Amendment is very clear, and it's not how it's being interpreted or applied today with the incorporation doctrine. Well, the 15th Amendment gave voting rights to former slaves. Again, this issue of voting should be at the state level, the state determining who the citizens are, who has the right, and who has the qualifications to vote, not the federal government. Of course, we know the 16th Amendment was never properly ratified in the first place, and certainly it's been misinterpreted in how it's being applied today. It would be best just to repeal the whole thing and to do away with it. We have talked earlier in the show about the 17th Amendment that gave broke the real way in which states could be a check against the powers of the federal government.
David, we're out of time. God bless you.
God
thanks
bless
so much
you,
for
Dr.
being
Sands,
with us. We'll talk to you again next month. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us. And if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family or subscribe to a newsletter, or if you'd just simply like to get one of our catalogs or one of our newsletters, well, we'd be glad to send it to you. So again, our number 1-800-544-8927. Then, of course, we hope that many of you will want to get the information we have on our Constitution in one of our best books, Betrayed by the Bench by John Stormer. That's Betrayed by the Bench by John Stormer. We recommend that. Certainly we have a four-tape set called the Foundations of Our Freedom. And it's a series of interviews that I did with a professor, a government professor. And it really gives you the background of the Declaration, certainly the Constitution, and in 4 hours, well, you'll have a really pretty good working knowledge of what it's all about and understand that we are losing our freedom because we don't understand what freedom is. Freedom is a vehicle of limiting the power of government so men can be free, but if men are not moral and don't act responsibility or act responsibly, then, of course, you have total chaos. What we need are men who will be ruled by God, and they're going to be ruled personally by God, not having somebody in government tell them what God said. And those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants, and that's just the direction America is headed today. And then, of course, there's a reason for what's happening. That's why you need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and it's available on DVD or the book. We recommend the book because it really gives you all of the documentation, so you can find out how and document the fact that there is no conflict between communism and capitalism. The communist movement was financed from the United States from its inception because we needed an enemy. And then, of course, well, why would anybody be that wicked and evil? Well, because there really are wicked and evil people out there in the world who frankly worship Satan and Lucifer. So that's, of course, you need to get my talk on the Forbidden Secret. You need to get our four tape or four CD set on The Secret Behind the Secret. The DVD, award-winning DVD, the best documentary of last year, and it was called The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, and then the sequel to that, Why the Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. You need to begin to understand how all of these things fit together. Because we're truly involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought on the political and ideological and cultural battlefield. If you're concerned about the loss of freedom, let me suggest some of our four tapers, four CD sets. The North American Union, the impending police state, and globalism. All of these are available. Go to our website of RadioLiberty.com and look at all of the various tape sets and videos and, of course, books that we offer. And, of course, you can listen to our radio programs there live 4 hours a day, and actually replay that. You get a nine-hour feed of Radio Liberty. You won't get much accomplished, but you'll learn an awful lot. And then, of course, you can watch many of our videos free of charge on our website. And then, of course, you can read our newsletters. They're up there. Pull them down. Copy them. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will want to get the little pamphlets we put together based upon those newsletters like Foreknowledge 911 or The Occult Hierarchy or The History of Money. We have, and of course, we go into the background of genetic engineering. It's all available upon Radio Liberty. Vaccines, the greatest scam ever put over on the American people, which is why certainly one out of every six American children has some sort of a neurodevelopmental abnormality. They're poisoning our children. They know what they're doing. Please pray for America. Remember our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be views of Mr. William Grieg, formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now certainly working full-time of writing and doing radio programs and educating people all across America about so many of the issues that are taking place. And certainly, it's always a pleasure to have William Grieg with us right here on Radio Liberty. Hi, William. How are you tonight?
Dr. Stan, good to be with you. I'm doing well.
Well, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
One of the things that's happened since last we spoke on last Friday that I thought was just a really dramatic way of punctuating or italicizing everything we talked about with respect to the economy was the news that the former partner of George Soros, Jim Rogers, who's this currency speculator of some renown and some standing, has announced that he's shifting all of his assets out of the dollar and buying the Chinese currency, the yuan or the renminbi, because of the conscious, deliberate debasement of the currency by the Federal Reserve. He was speaking a few days ago to a meeting organized by a group called ABN AMRO Markets in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. He said he expects the Chinese currency, and I'm quoting now from a Bloomberg news release, expects the Chinese currency to quadruple in the next decade, and also that he's holding on to commodities, precious metals, such as platinum, gold, silver, and palladium, which is all very intelligent, of course. But what's really interesting is that he's moving out of the world's reserve currency, the fiat dollar, which has been completely uncoupled from gold since Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard completely in the early 70s. He's moving out of that reserve currency into a fiat currency issued by a communist government, which is a really remarkable thing. He would rather have his holdings denominated in the Chinese yuan than in the American dollar. And this is what he said: I'm in the process, I hope in the next few months, of getting all my assets out of the U.S. dollars. I'm that pessimistic about what's happening in the United States. It's the official policy of the central bank of the U.S. to debase the currency, said Rogers. The U.S. dollar is and has been the world's reserve currency, the world's medium of exchange. That's in the process of changing. The pound sterling, which used to be the world's reserve currency, lost 80% of its value top to bottom as it went through the whole period of losing its status as the world's reserve currency. As for the Chinese currency, known as the renminbi or yuan, Mr. Rogers said, it is the best currency to buy right now. I don't see how one can really lose on the renminbi in the next decade or so. It's got to go. It's got to triple. It's got to quadruple. He's also buying Swiss francs and Japanese yen. The thing is, Mr. Rogers, like George Soros, is a currency speculator. He's somebody who could be looked upon, I guess, as a jackal, in a sense. These are people who find ways of hedging their investments based on what they expect the negative performance of a given national currency to be. And Mr. Soros has become quite disreputable in international circles because he's somebody who is, on occasion, I've been so active in speculating on currency that has driven some national currencies almost into oblivion. But it's really interesting that this fellow, who knows which way the wind is blowing, is getting out of the dollar entirely. That's a bad augury of hard times to come.
And I think that most Americans, of course, if you listen to our programs, they're aware of the fact that we have a fiat money system. And, of course, everything that the Federal Reserve has done over the last 36 years has been to destroy the very foundation of our monetary system. And you destroy the basis of a currency, you destroy the stability of the nation. And that is exactly what has been happening. Between 1971 and 2005, they increased the money in circulation 12-fold and the debt 19-fold.
Well,
go right ahead.
In today's New York Times, there was a story which illustrates one of the really visible and tangible effects of what we're talking about here. the lead of this story says, every time economists and Wall Street executives think they have acknowledged the full extent of the losses from the meltdown in real estate mortgages, more bad news turns up. Merrill Lynch said yesterday that it would take a charge for mortgage-related securities on its books that is $3 billion more than the $5 billion expected just 2 weeks ago. And a report from the National Association of Realtors showed that sales of existing homes in September fell twice as much as economists had expected, to their lowest level in nearly 10 years. And then the really interesting part of the story comes in the following paragraph. Stocks fell sharply early yesterday, that is the 24th, on Wednesday, on the news, with the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index falling 1.8% before recovering in the afternoon. Investors also bid up treasuries as they sought the safety of government-backed debt. That's a really fascinating phrase, sought the safety of government-backed debt. What does the government have in order to insure or to indemnify debt? It has us. It has the taxpayers. It has the product of our labor. And in principle, basically, it has everything that we own up to and including the very flesh and blood that God gave us, both in terms of our own bodies and in terms of the persons of our children. I am still of the opinion that in some not terribly distant time, in order to stave off our foreign creditors, the people to whom our government has become beholden, that there's going to be some kind of a grand bargain involving compulsory national service, both for military and non-military purposes, and that young people, as a condition of being permitted to attend college, which would be considered the gateway to having a decent prospect of a good job as an adult, they would have to serve some defined term, be it 2 years, be it 4 years or more, as either working as a conscript, as a draftee, in the military, in Homeland Security, in a UN peacekeeping force, or in some other capacity as part of a way of paying off the debts or making payments on the debts. You know, one of the things that your listeners probably are aware of is the fact that people who are in the business of marketing debt don't want people who pay off debts. They want people who make payments. It's not a question of lending money on the assumption that at some point this person's going to pay off in full, but rather you want to find ways of keeping him in debt, you know, making sure that he's paying off the interest.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Greig. William is saying that there's so many people today who are being told, well, people are not certain, that it's uncertainty out there, so people are going to go to something that really, of course, has stability, somewhere they can put their money where they're not going to lose value, and so they're going to put it in treasury bonds. Now, that really sounds great, and through the years, this has always been what people said. Yes, if you don't know what's going to happen, put your money into T-bills. You don't make a lot of money, but at least you've got stability. Ladies and gentlemen, the T-bills are denominated in dollars, mm-hmm. and the value of the dollar is falling. The value of the dollar has fallen certainly well over 40% in the last 3 years. Prior to that, it had lost 96% of its value, and it's lost another 40% in relationship to the euro currency of over the last 3 years. And what the smart people are doing is getting out of dollars, because it doesn't matter whether you have them in T-bills or T-notes or you know, in annuities or insurance policies. I had some fellow tell me today that he is really going to play it smart. He's going to invest in this insurance policy that is going to guarantee him, you know, when he gets to be a certain age, to pay him, $5,000 a month up until the time he's 100. And I said, that's very good, but what will $5,000 a month buy you? Look and see what's going on in Zimbabwe today. The people who have pensions in Zimbabwe, pension that they worked a whole life for, and they get it, it won't buy 3 or 4 slices of bread for an entire month,
mm-hmm.
because they've destroyed the value of the Rhodesian or the Zimbabwean dollar. When I was there and lived in Africa, it took 3 American dollars to buy 1 Zimbabwean dollar. Today it takes probably 60,000 to 80,000, or at least 40,000 to 60,000 Rhodesian dollars to buy 1 American dollar. And that, of course, is Sydney, the official rate of return. They have 20 to 30,000 percent a year inflation in Zimbabwe. And remember, the American State Department brought that government to power.
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
Well, one of the things that's happening in Zimbabwe, obviously, is that the government not interested in dealing with the currency that it is debasing. It doesn't want to do business in that currency. I mean, what they're doing is they're seizing land from people, and it's not just because they want to control all the economic activity of the country, which, of course, is a defining characteristic of any communist regime, but it's also because land is worth something and the Zimbabwean dollar is not. I mean, that stands to reason. These two things synergize with each other. When you have a government that wants to control the economy, that, of course, includes controlling the currency and defining the currency to suit its whims, and one of the things that every government in that frame of mind will be to inflate and ruin the value of the currency. And so people are seeking the shelter of government-backed debt here in the United States. That government-backed debt, of course, is denominated in dollars. The value of the dollar is being propped up by Saudi Arabia, Japan, and China. Saudi Arabia is not following the lead of the U.S. Central Bank. They're not inflating to match the inflation of the Federal Reserve, which means that they're slowly starting to step away from the dollar. And what has kept the dollar liquid since it was decoupled from gold in 1971 has been basically the Saudi government's willingness to charge only dollars in exchange for the petroleum that it exports and is the dominant voice in the OPEC cartel. They've defined that policy that in effect has kept the dollar somewhat stable by backing it with Persian Gulf oil, you know, the petrodollar. Well, the petrodollar is starting to lose that foundation as the Gulf states, beginning with Saudi Arabia, start to move away from the inflationary policies of the Federal Reserve. I mentioned China. China being, of course, one of the largest holders of U.S. backed debts, one of the largest holders of T-bills. And we just mentioned how Jim Rogers is moving out of the dollar and into the Chinese currency. And what that suggests to me, of course, is that ere long, people are going to be in full flight from the dollar. And so if you have government-backed debt, it will be just as worthless as any other kind of debt. The only difference, I suppose, would be that eventually your creditors will be the people who hold the paper on our government's debt, which would be people like China and Saudi Arabia. And I think at some point in the not terribly distant future, this is something we discussed on programs previously and I was talking about before the break, we might see where some of these grand designs will come to fruition. A proposal has been made and circulated by groups connected to the Center for American Policy, the CAP, and the Council on Foreign Relations, where they would reinstitute some form of conscription as national service, both domestically and internationally. You'd have a military draft. You would have national service for the purpose of homeland security, for the purpose of tending to our aging population, which is, of course, going to be a huge factor in all this. The first baby boomers are starting to collect Social Security. We're going to end up basically with health care, long-term health care for the aging population, consuming everything in our economy, sucking up everything in our economy. We're going to get socialized medicine by default because of the demographic realities and the actuarial realities of an aging baby boomer population and radically expanding Medicare benefits in particular. I mean, that was the handiwork of George W. Bush and the Republicans. This prescription drug benefit that they rammed through that's going to cost trillions of dollars.
And it's unfunded. There's no money to pay it.
Exactly.
That's the incredible thing.
Yeah. There's your government-backed debt right there. I mean, that's a promissory note, the size of which we don't know yet. They said it would cost no more than $400 billion as if that were mere chump change. They literally pulled that number out of their emunctory aperture. And they did that because they knew that was the top bid that the Republican leadership at that time said they were willing to accept in terms of the cost estimates for this program. Well, no, that was a lie, and it was known at the time that was a lie, and a criminal conspiracy, I use that expression in a specific sense, a criminal conspiracy was undertaken by the Bush administration to conceal from Congress the true dimensions of what that program would cost, and now we know that it will cost something in the trillions of dollars, the unspecified trillions of dollars, because we don't know. Nobody knows. But as the baby boomers age, you're going to have this huge population will have to be tended to somehow. Our money's going to become worthless. What do you have left when the money's no longer good? Well, you basically have that which supposedly money substitutes for, and that is human exertion. I mean, the fundamental premise of currency is that you pay somebody money in order to transfer the burden to somebody else of doing something you want done, whether that is providing you with a finished product or providing you with exertion in the form of productive labor. So when money's no longer any good, you can either see something tangible that is either a product or an asset that's valuable, or you can seize the physical exertion of somebody. And I suspect that what's going to happen as we face the prospect of hyperinflation is that our rulers will look at our young population and say, look, here are these all these teenagers who need jobs. They need something to do that's worthwhile. Why don't we put them to work doing something that's for the good of the entire community? And, of course, that means something that is defined by the government as being for the good of the entire community as opposed to that which the market would dictate, which really shows what's good for the community. And so I can't help but suspect that we're being set up for that kind of a grand bargain that would involve a literal return to unabashed, unambiguous serfdom, whether you're talking about military conscription once again or whether you're talking about what the Eighth Plague of the Communist Manifesto described as huge armies for industry and agriculture. I'm trying to remember exactly what the plank says, but the paraphrase would be that they talked about building industrial armies for the purpose of agriculture and other undertakings. And I suspect that's the direction we're going to head. And I don't think that it'll take that much longer because I just do not know what's propping the dollar up apart from the fact that we're in the final stages of a shared delusion that is really hard for people to shake, I guess.
I think the people really don't want to accept the fact that the dollar is going to be destroyed. And with that will be destroyed the value of their annuities, the values of their pensions, their Social Security. You'll get your Social Security pension, it just won't buy much of anything. And certainly the money that people put in their T-bonds and T-bills and T-notes and the money they have in their CDs. We always think of this, you know, as something inherently valuable because the dollar has been stable. It is no longer stable. This is part of a long-range plan. They're intentionally destroying the value of our currency. And with that, of course, the savings of a large part of our population are the smart people like George Soros and Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Jimmy Rogers. They're, of course, getting their money out of the United States. They're putting it in gold and silver. I don't know what you saw what happened to gold and silver today, but silver, I think, closed over a 1380 somewhere in there, and the gold was pushing a 770. I think it was 768 somewhere in there. And it is only a matter of time before these things go through the roof as the dollar falls to the basement. But people do not understand that with that goes everything that they think that they have any security. And, of course, as you and I both know, William, our only real security is in the Lord, but we ordinarily have this idea that we're going to be protected because we have money in the bank. And you may have money in the bank, but it may not really buy much of anything at all. And, of course, what is really so interesting, I was ordering from a catalog just the other day, 2 days ago, and as I was ordering from the catalog, and, of course, the prices are there, but the woman, of course, taking my order, insisted on reading back the price. And the price literally on everything has gone up here in the last few months.
Yeah.
Nothing is what it cost 2 months ago. The government says, oh, inflation's only 2.1%. And they are simply lying. Look at the price of oil. Look at the price of food. Look at the price of medical care. Look at the price of housing here in California. Rentals have gone up almost 10% here, 9 to 10% in this past year.
Yeah, and a lot of that represents the migration of people out of homes they can't afford into rental units that they can't afford. I mean, once people come to the understanding that they better get out of their mortgages while they can, you know, taking a loss, almost all of them would take a bath here because of the collapsing of the housing bubble, which started really in some places in the Midwest and sort of jumped across the continent to the left coast, you know, California, Nevada, a few other places like that. So people are migrating into rentals. Rentals have gone up dramatically in Boise and the suburbs. Boise is the only city here in the state of Idaho, really, and there are some other exurbs of Boise, such as Meridian, where there had been a lot of building up until about a year ago. Then it just stopped, literally. It just stopped in a matter of weeks, and now we've got still some residual building. You've got the inertia of the market going on. But they're building units that people are not going to be able to afford to buy. In the meantime, of course, rents have gone up concomitantly. We get a lot of people coming up from California into Idaho precisely for the reasons we're talking about. In addition to some other problems, of course, there are all kinds of bad things going on in California. You've got a state government that's perfectly insane. And so a lot of people are coming up here as refugees from California, but a lot of them are fleeing the escaping, they're fleeing the collapsing housing bubble, trying to find some place where it's a little bit more economical to live. But one of the things that's happening as well as the housing bubble collapses, and this is something else that I think we've discussed before, is the fact that state and local governments are becoming cash-strapped. When that happens, people who run those governments become sort of nasty. That was something described in the New York Times again, talking about a decline of $917 million in lost property tax revenue to state and local governments, which will also have to spend more on policing neighborhoods with vacant homes. The states most likely to be hard hit fall into two categories, those where prices have been rising fastest, like California and Florida, and Midwest states with weak economies, like Michigan and Ohio, where people with low or moderate incomes made heavy use of subprime loans to become homeowners and consolidate debt. That was something else that Bush was really pushing in 2004, was the idea that everybody should be a homeowner. Well, ideally, everybody could be a homeowner if the government had not been debasing the currency and tinkering with the economy in ways that made it almost impossible for people to buy a home, to make a decent wage, not have their earnings devoured by inflation. Back in the 1950s, it was very common to see a one-wage earner family have a home that was paid for within a reasonable amount of time, two cars in the garage, and maintain a standard of living that's quite enviable now, although they didn't have the plethora of conveniences and amenities that we have. At least they had a comfortable home that they owned, and they had a good standard of living where the mother was able to stay at home and help raise the kids. I mean, to provide the primary direction of the lives of the children. That, of course, is the ideal. That's the beau ideal of the what's called the American dream. We don't have that now, but Bush and his cronies back in 2004 were promoting through Fannie and Freddie and Ginnie Mae, all the government-sponsored entities that are involved in the loan industry, and through HUD, which supervises a lot of these programs, encouraging people to go out and buy homes, particularly in what we call the inner city, in places like Ohio and Michigan and so forth. And a lot of these people went out and got subprime loans because their credit histories weren't adequate to support the type of loans that a lot of other people would get. And now they're basically walking away from these loans, leaving these houses abandoned, and that creates problems for property values in entire neighborhoods. And so with that going on, you've got these cities starting to take over the upkeep and the management of these homes in a desperate effort to keep the property values up so that they can eventually get more property taxes out of people in order to run their own engines of plunder and redistribution. And that means, of course, they have to spend more on police. So where do they get money for the police? Well, they get money by starting to enforce all those diddling, stupid, picayune, anal-retentive laws that are on the books that they can use to wheedle people out of their income. They start really enforcing arcane zoning ordinances having to do with the height of the grass in your front yard and the upkeep of your automobiles and other things that are considered code violations. They'll send people out to start writing people up for that so as to get money flowing into the coffers of the local government.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stad, and of course, William is simply talking about how governments are getting more and more desperate for money. After all, they have all their pensions that they have to pay to the politicians,
yeah,
and the health care for the politicians, and then they have they've made fantastic promises to state employees. We're going to let you retire when you're 50 years old. We're going to give you a great pension. We're going to give you health benefits for the rest of your life. You got nothing to worry about. The only trouble is, where's the money coming from? Well, I read the ultimate just the other day in Chicago. Mayor Daley is talking about installing video cameras on the street sweeping trucks that go up and down the streets there. So they found somebody who was parked where they shouldn't be, and they, of course, with a video camera, they were able to identify the car and their license plate. Then they could, of course, send them a bill. The ultimate, of course, you know, they're installing their video cameras at intersections. And
yeah,
if you run a light, if there's even a question, you run a light, they're going to send you a large bill.
Mm-hmm.
And everything, of course, is going to be to wring money out of the individuals. If they were to search your home and they were to find that you had $10,000 in cash there, they would simply steal it because you might be a drug dealer. And then it's up to you to prove that that you got it legitimately. But why would you want to have money in your home? Everybody has their money in the bank. So what they're doing this all across the country. They're using the police to steal money from law-abiding citizens so they can go into the public coffers to pay for all the goodies for the government employees.
The really interesting thing about what you're describing here, what's called civil asset forfeiture, which is one of the manifold gifts provided to us by this wise and benevolent undertaking called the War on Drugs, which has done nothing to mitigate the problem of drug addiction, but a great deal to get governments and police forces addicted to illicit proceeds from forfeiture. That's something that is going to go through the ceiling, and it already is. It's really gone viral. It's gone exponential just in the last decade or so, and it's going to get worse for the reasons you just alluded to, Dr. Stan. As people start to lose their confidence in the banking system, and they're going to have to. Already we have bank runs going on over in England for many of the same reasons that we're going to start seeing them happen here again. People are going to start keeping more of their cash on hand. They're going to have to. They're not going to be able to keep it in savings accounts or in CDs or in other investments of that sort. They're going to have cash on hand. That's one of the things that happens when inflation starts to spike and when the banking system starts to become a little dodgy. People are going to keep that on hand. So, given the fact that we're going to have more cash in more homes, I predict, and I can do this with a great deal of serene confidence, that we're going to see more and more civil asset forfeitures going on. For the same reason that Mr. Sutton once gave the answer of why he robbed banks. That's where the money is. The money will be in people's homes, and we will find more and more pretextual midnight, full-force, no-knock, or even warrantless raids that will result in more asset forfeiture. You mentioned red light cameras. Red light cameras are pullulating across the countryside like mushrooms after a hard summer rain for the very same reason. That's one of the main arteries of revenue is the red light cameras and traffic violations, traffic citations of that sort. You mentioned Mayor Daley in the long-suffering city of Chicago. Illinois, not just Chicago, but Illinois in general, central Illinois in particular, is just overrun with schemes to confiscate automobiles. Automobile confiscation is a huge business right now. California's got some of the most insane automobile confiscation ordinances in the world. Some of the sheriff's departments down there will confiscate an automobile on the slimmest of pretexts. I'm looking at an article right now talking about the fact that a small town called Rossville, Illinois, has a new program that will permit the police at their discretion to seize automobiles if they think that they're making too much noise. Because they just passed the city ordinance. And they usually pass as emergency ordinances. That's another thing that I find very significant. It's if you're dealing with some kind of a crisis. Well, the crisis is, as you pointed out, that the municipal governments, the county governments, have parasitical constituents that they have to keep fed, and they don't have enough money to do it. And so that becomes a crisis for them. It's not a crisis for the community. It's a crisis for that institutionalized affliction that we call the governing class. But here in Rossville, Illinois, it says that the article I'm reading from says the village will also authorize police to grab a vehicle if an unruly passenger resists an officer's commands. The ordinance was approved last week. Rossville trustee Dick Queen said, if a kid has loud mufflers, give him a ticket, don't take his car. He objected to the ordinance. I think it's wrong to punish the driver for what a passenger does. But the ordinance passed. And now they have the means of seizing an automobile and charging a very lucrative extortionate fee in order to get that automobile back. If you're somebody whose automobile is seized, it'll be hundreds or even thousands of dollars to get it back by the time they're finished with you.
And, of course, you know, supposedly the police are there to serve the public. But when, of course, you have a bankrupt society, morally bankrupt, financially bankrupt, they've got to raise the money. After all, how are they going to continue paying the salaries to the government employees and the retired employees and the politicians? Oh, the politicians and their friends. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, William Grigg. Go right ahead, William.
One of the things that I think should be mentioned here is that it's not just the muffler ordinances that are being used in order to justify the summary seizure of an automobile by the police. And by the way, that's an example of the principle called in rem, against the thing. When police conduct a drug raid on an apartment and they decide that they will seize the cash that they find as if it were connected to drug trafficking, it's not necessary to charge the owner of the cash with a crime. You simply say, well, we suspect that there's a drug nexus connecting that cash to the narcotics trade. And then they prosecute the cash and they confiscate it. The Dallas County, Iowa Sheriff's Department literally made millions of dollars over the last 5 or 6 years by doing this. They'd send out cars on the interstate. The I-80 runs right through Dallas County, Iowa. And they would look for people, particularly Hispanic men, as somebody who's of Latino ancestry. I thought it was interesting. I drove through that county just a few months before I discovered what was going on. They're driving an SUV, then they fit the profile of a supposed drug courier, and if they can find cash in the automobile, they'll confiscate the automobile and the cash, and in order for the person to get his automobile back, he has to surrender the cash. And then the cash is prosecuted. What will happen is that they'll put a notice in the paper inviting anybody to come and claim an amount of money that has been confiscated as suspected drug proceeds. Nobody will claim it because in order to get the automobile out of the custody of the police, the person who owns the automobile has to sign his rights to the money away. And Brian Gilbert, the sheriff of Dallas County, went to jail just this last year because he had stolen several hundred thousand dollars. He had simply taken several sacks of cash home with him. And the thing I find ironic is that he was prosecuted for taking for his personal use something that had been stolen by that sheriff's department to be lavished on the county government. It was okay to steal as long as the county in general was profiting from the theft. But when Mr. Gilbert got a little bit too greedy and decided to use inappropriate some of this for his personal use, he went to jail. And this was a scandal, obviously, that got a lot of publicity in Iowa. And the lesson that was learned here, according to the custodians of polite opinion in Iowa and the press, in the television media and other outlets, was that there had to be reforms of asset forfeiture. The practice of asset forfeiture had to be reformed, as if you could somehow make more genteel the practice of vulgar highway robbery, which is what it is. In Illinois, Chicago seizes 25,000 cars every year. The Cook County seizure program...
Left off right there.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply talking about the corrupt asset seizure programs that are certainly being enforced all across America, where the police are not being used to protect the public. They're being used to steal from the public under the name of asset forfeiture because government needs more money. And many of the people who have their assets stolen are not criminals at all. They're people who just want to have currency because they don't trust the banking system and they sure don't trust the government.
Yeah.
Before we go on, William, I want you to get out your web page. Tell people how they can get the excellent material that you're offering free of charge up there on your web page. And what about that new book of yours? When's that going to be along?
Well, what happened is that with the book, we had some last-minute problems with sizing and finding the right format for the photographs that are going in the center of the book, but that problem was solved today, and I received an email from the typesetter about an hour and a half, 2 hours ago, and he said that it's going to be in the hands of the printer tomorrow. So by next week, for sure, we're going to have copies of the new book. It's entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. And it goes into some detail describing the militarization of the police, the federalization of our law enforcement system, and the fact that what was once a decentralized, constitutionally appropriate law enforcement system based on local accountability and the idea that the police existed to protect the rights of the individuals, the constitutionally defined and protected rights of the individuals were part of the job description, maintaining and protecting is the job description of local police. Now what we have is basically an army of occupation where the federal government has created a mindset on the part of the people running our police system in which the public is looked upon as the enemy, and their job is to make us submit to the supposed authority of the state. and it goes into detail talking about some of the really horrific things that have happened, the institutionalization of torture being one of them, the increasing practice of what is called extraordinary rendition, which is just kidnapping people who are considered terror suspects, shipping them to third countries where torture is practiced as a way of outsourcing torture as a form of interrogation, the creation of what has to be considered a dictatorial executive on the pretext of fighting the war on terrorism, and also the destruction of habeas corpus, the fundamental due process guarantee, which requires the government to justify imprisoning a citizen. If the government can simply imprison us without legal recourse, then we have no rights of any sort that the government has to respect. And that's something which has gone by the books now, as of the passage a year ago on October 17th of 2006 of the Military Commissions Act. We no longer really have a habeas corpus guarantee. Absent that, we do not have a due process, corpus of due process protections that we would recognize. That book will be out next week. It's about 300 pages long, but it's a very brisk read because most of it's slightly terrifying, I'm afraid to say. For those who are interested in examining the work that I and my associates are doing for the Welch Foundation, we have a web portal called The Right Source. And the address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's one word, rightsourceonline.com. You type that into your search browser, and then you look at the screen that comes up, scroll down about a third of the way through the page, look at the left-hand side of the screen, you'll find my photograph. And next to my photograph, you'll find two hot links. The one furthest to the right will take you to my daily blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate. And Pro Libertate is a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. That was the motto, I think it's interesting to point out, on the Wallace family crest, as in William Wallace of Scotland, the figure in that movie Braveheart, which is my favorite film. I have a son named William Wallace, not coincidentally. But go to that link, and the Pro Libertate website, the news blog, is updated almost daily, between 4 and 6 times a week. And that's something that you can access, once again, by way of the Right Source, which is rightsourceonline.com.
And let me recommend that site to you. Excellent material. You'll want to pull that down. You'll want to read it, study it, and understand that William is going to keep you right abreast on the very cutting edge of what's going on. Because freedom is under attack today. And if the American people don't care about their freedom, then who will?
Yeah.
If not now, when? Go ahead.
Well, I was talking about what's going on in the Midwest now with automobile confiscation, which I think is just really a terribly important symptom of the times in which we live. They used to shoot horse thieves or string them up, and this is something that is really the modern equivalent of horse theft, I think, is when people simply summarily seize your car. And I mentioned that in Chicago, 25,000 cars are seized every year, most of them on the flimsiest of pretexts. Cook County has a car snatching program that earns something like $1.7 million a year. I'm reading that from an account on thenewspaper.com. That's a really interesting website for people who are interested in what they call the politics of driving. Driving, that is, automobile ownership and use of automobiles, that's something innately American. I mean, that's one of the things that we gave the world that was unique in history, is the freedom of the open road. And it's interesting to reflect on the fact that that circumstance in which most people are likeliest to have an adverse encounter, an aversive encounter with law enforcement, would occur when you're behind the wheel of an automobile, when you're exercising one of the defining freedoms of the American culture, which is that of driving along the open road. And it's getting more and more difficult to enjoy that freedom for a number of reasons. The newspaper.com follows these stories very diligently and reports on them quite plangently. But here, the newspaper commenting on this automobile seizure epidemic says, of a number of towns in Illinois, the jurisdictions have also come up with a number of clever ways to accuse motorists of crimes meriting confiscation. Rockford and Peoria will seize cars with loud stereos. Oak Forest will seize the car of anyone accused of crimes like shoplifting that have nothing whatsoever to do with driving. In all jurisdictions, the seizure takes place upon a mere accusation by police, not after any finding of guilt in a court of law. Kane County will even keep a confiscated car belonging to a motorist later found innocent. These things are happening every day in this country, although most people don't pay attention to this, and when these stories tend to make their way into the news, most of the time people simply shake their head and say, well, isn't that a really interesting thing, and then go on as if this is not something terribly significant, that in various jurisdictions in this country, the government can simply vulgarly steal your car from you, which means that they're almost certainly making it impossible for you to work, among other things. On the flimsiest of pretexts, you don't have to be found guilty of a crime. Often you don't have to be arraigned for a crime. They simply steal the car and then charge you a fee to get your car back, and irrespective of whether or not you're actually charged with a crime, much less convicted of a crime, they keep the money. That's the whole point of the exercise. The state and local governments in this country, the municipalities, county governments, can't print money. They can borrow it. They can ruin their credit. A lot of them do that very frequently. But they can't print it. They don't have the same luxury that the Leviathan headquarters in Washington, D.C. has. So simply going to the Federal Reserve, asking them to take out their magic checkbook and exhalate a certain quantity of fiat currency that they get the first use of. States, municipalities, county governments can't do that. They have to find some other way of shaking people down. And now that the assessed value of homes is going to start going down because the inflated prices are starting to subside, they're going to become very desperate to find new sources of revenue. And so we're going to see a whole raft of programs like this go through, where they're going to pervert the police power into a vulgar instrument of revenue collection. And it's going to get much, much nastier. And we've not even started to see bad here. I mean, as bad as it is right now, we've not really seen bad yet.
And I certainly agree with you, but I think every American should be concerned when police are certainly being encouraged not to simply enforce the law, but to become vehicles for collecting a tariff from people who are driving on the open road. And when they will actually, of course, take your car, accuse you of a crime, and then if you're exonerated, they keep your car. What sort of madness is that? Government is supposed, of course, to be our servant, not our master, but unfortunately we've gotten away from those concepts, and increasingly they've militarized our police. Now we're increasingly justifying the use of torture and brutality, and all you have to do is watch the various detective programs on television, Law and Order and the others, and the hero's always beating somebody or pounding the head against the wall, but it's always justified. That's the only way we can get them to talk and tell us where the little girl is being hidden or something of the sort. So we justify the use of brutality by our police, and our minds are being molded, our ideas suggested by the people who control our television networks, and that is, of course, one of five mega corporations that largely determine what the American people hear and read and see, and ultimately what they believe.
Yeah, you're talking, when you're referring to this gospel of righteous police violence that's being preached constantly, both in detective dramas and also through quasi-reality programs such as Cops and other programs that ilk, you're talking about something that I call either the Sipowicz syndrome or the Showtime syndrome. Sipowicz, of course, refers to Andy Sipowicz, the character played by Dennis Franz in NYPD Blue, who would often take somebody into a locked interrogation room and then light him up, meaning simply beat him. You know, usually the fellow would be handcuffed, and the way that the story was written, he was always somebody who was perfectly loathsome. Problem is, it doesn't work that way, or at least it shouldn't work that way in a constitutional law system. You should have a system of which, however loathsome the person appears to be, and however heinous the crime of which he's accused, until you can prove that he committed the crime, he's a law-abiding, innocent citizen. You have to overcome that presumption in order to punish him. When you're talking about what I call the Showtime syndrome, I believe that the expectations of people who go into law enforcement have been torqued by the same media output that we're describing here. The way that, for instance, in quasi-reality shows such as Cops, you always see the worst of the worst being tracked down by the heroic paladins of public order in blue. And I really believe that in some circumstances where police do things that are just so obviously and unmistakably wrong, such as the case in Virginia a couple of weeks ago, I wrote about this in my blog last week, where a police officer was driving an SUV through an intersection without his lights on, but without his siren, running through a crosswalk and endangering pedestrians, and one of the pedestrians shouted at this police officer. Police officer responded by getting out of the car, throwing the kid to the ground, handcuffing him. When his girlfriend objected, he threw her to the ground, just shoved her to the ground on her back, inflicting upon her a very painful back injury that's going to require a lot of expensive medical therapy to fix. You know, did this because the guy had shouted at him, warning him away from the crosswalk, because it endangered the lives of pedestrians. I'm sure that what was going through, what passes through the mind of this bully in blue, was that he simply doesn't have to take that from a civilian. You know, I'm sure that at some point a switch was thrown and he said, it's showtime, and he wanted to throw down and show everybody that he is all that. And you find that happening altogether too often right now, because the moral standards and the training and the discipline that would produce police officers of the sort that you and I once esteemed, all that's absent now. And I think that recruiting standards have fallen so abysmally low that they're getting a rather overrepresented sample of the sort of people who really enjoy pushing other human beings around. And there's this element of the human personality, this element of the fallen, degenerate human personality called the libido dominandi, the lust for power, that is becoming very obvious in a lot of the people who are now exercising coercive power on behalf of the state. They would have been the first weeded out in the recruitment process a generation ago, and now I think they're coming to define too many police departments, which is a terrible tragedy. One of the other things that I think is really interesting is how the enforcement of laws against driving under the influence, driving while intoxicated, in many states, Arizona, some parts of Texas, some parts of southern Utah, now it's becoming very, very common for police to require a blood sample from a driver as a way of determining the blood alcohol content. There's a defense attorney, former prosecutor in a small town in Texas who specializes in DUI, DWI defenses. He points out that while driving under the influence and endangering the lives of other people is a very serious thing, as a crime, it really is what he calls a crime of opinion. A police officer has to make a subjective assessment as to whether he suspects that somebody has had too much to drink, because you don't know, first of all, what the blood alcohol content of a given driver is unless you can test that, and secondly, you don't know what blood alcohol content level would actually lead to intoxication that changes from person to person. And so what he says is that basically there's sort of a constitutional exception, or rather it's a constitution-free zone that occurs anytime a police officer is starting to interrogate somebody about driving under the influence, because what they're asking basically is for the person to incriminate himself. First of all, have you been drinking? Well, I don't really want to tell you that, officer. If you say that to a police officer, he'll arrest you. And he shouldn't be able to arrest you in that circumstance, because he's got no right to expect you to incriminate yourself. But in a lot of jurisdictions now, not only do they require you to undergo on the spot a test, sobriety test, a field test, which of course is very, very unreliable and liable to all types of subjective assessments by the police officer, and not merely a breathalyzer test, which is a form, once again, of invasion of your personal privacy, but to force you to surrender a blood sample. In Arizona, if you refuse to give a blood sample, they will confiscate your driver's license for a year. Whether or not you're actually under the influence of alcohol, if you simply do not want to have your body penetrated by a hypodermic needle being wielded by somebody who is not a medical professional, and furthermore, somebody who has every incentive to make sure that you are found guilty because he's collecting revenue that will provide him with a paycheck. If under those circumstances you do not surrender your body to be punctured by this hypodermic needle-wielding oaf, they will take your license away for a year without having proven in a court of law that you've committed a crime. And in New Jersey, just a couple of days ago, there was a decision handed down by an appellate court that upheld the supposed authority of police in circumstances of the sort I'm describing to use excessive force that amounts to torture in order to extract a blood sample from a resisting suspect. The case involved a man who was taken to the hospital, if I remember correctly. No. He was taken to the hospital. He refused to give a blood sample, which, of course, he should be able to do. I mean, you shouldn't be in a position where the federal government can require you to surrender a blood sample. I just simply cannot see how the government can do that. I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, I mentioned the Fifth Amendment. There's Fourth Amendment prohibition against unreasonable searches. There's a Sixth Amendment guarantee of counsel. I mean, this guy was in the hospital. Three or four police officers held him down. One of them put his entire weight on the guy's wrist and broke it in order to force him to give a blood sample. The state of New Jersey and appellate court just upheld this as a reasonable use of police force.
Well, I think we have real problems here, Chris. So what do you do, though, if the man is frankly drunk, and how do you prove that without a blood sample?
Yeah, how do you prove it? I mean, you can't prove on the basis of somebody's blood alcohol content that he is intoxicated. And they reduced that dramatically just 10 years ago. What was an acceptable BAC level in 1998 no longer is. That was the federal government's intervention.
All right, we're out of time. Hold on. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up the program with William Grigg. Well, William, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
I do think that it's finally become obvious to most people, reasonably observant, that there is a dramatic change that has taken place in law enforcement. You and I, Dr. Stan, I know that we've shared the same perspective on law enforcement for most of our lives. You know, a lot of people have asked why I've been so critical of the police in my blog, including people who are former law enforcement or current law enforcement whom I consider to be personal friends. You know, why are you suddenly beating up on the police? I don't mean to beat up on the police as such. It's the policymakers that are using the police in all these iniquitous ways who are really responsible for what's going on. But you have to recognize we no longer have the same system that existed even 20 years ago. It's a law enforcement system that is now federalized. It is now radically and extensively militarized. It has become the tool of what Frederick Bastiat, the great free market economist, described as the law perverted. The law, properly understood, is supposed to protect the individual rights, the God-given individual rights of the citizenry, whereas the perverted law is intended to make those citizens submit to a ruling elite that will treat them basically as raw material for their own grandiose designs and social engineering.
But aren't there some police officers who are trying to do a good job and within the limits of the law?
Oh, yeah, there are tens of thousands of them who are trying to do a good job. As a matter of fact, I'd say that those who are positively depraved are a very, very small minority. The problem is that the depraved element within law enforcement tends to be found, first of all, at the administrative level, and that would be, of course, level police chiefs and altogether too many sheriffs, for instance, police commissioners and people of that like who liaise with the federal government, the Homeland Security Department, and so forth. And secondly, they tend to cluster around the tactical units and SWAT teams and other paramilitary organizations within the police departments. Those are sort of the bayonet point, if you will, for the Homeland Security regime, and they're really troublesome. And caught between them, of course, are the majority, and I'm content that it is still a majority, of decent, honorable, constitutionally oriented police officers who went into law enforcement because they wanted to protect individual rights, because they wanted to protect the innocent from the depredations of the criminally violent. They're in a terrible position, and boy, my heart goes out to them because a lot of them are slowly being driven crazy by the system they're in right now. When they're not purged, like Officer Ramon Perez, in Austin, who was fired, you know, this outstanding police officer in his early 40s, was fired because he would not use his taser on an unresisting senior citizen.
No, we're out of time. God bless. Thanks.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope that you enjoyed our interview with Sidney William Grigg. And, of course, during the off-court there, I asked you, but aren't there a lot of good police officers? And Sidney William acknowledges that the vast majority of police officers are trying to do a good job. The problem is we have some very, very ruthless and brutal police officers. Usually they get promoted to key positions. And, of course, in that capacity, and certainly in the militarized sections of our police force, which is the SWAT teams and elsewhere, why, of course, they can use that brutality, and it's accepted. What we need, of course, is moral police officers, moral citizens. What we need to do is return to a moral society. Because, as has been said so many times before, those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants. And I feel that this is very much the way we're going today, and of course in the name of fighting the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's sitting in a cave in Pakistan with a laptop computer on his lap, and of course they're reading by candlelight. We, of course, have to militarize our police, and we have to certainly be able to use the American military against American citizens. We have to repeal the Posse Comitatus law. We have to have the federal government be able to use the National Guard without the permission of our state governors, because if we don't have this absolute power in the hands of our federal government, why, Osama bin Laden's going to take away our freedom. Ladies and gentlemen, we're in real trouble. If you want to understand what's really going on and what energizes the people who are using the threat of terrorism to justify the implementation of a dictatorship in America, let me suggest our four tape sets on the Military Commission Act, and that's four tape or four CDs, certainly on the North American Union, on the impending police state, three great four tape sets, and then, of course, we do hope that many of you will certainly go to our website, RadioLiberty.com, and look at the material we have there, that you want to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, that you want to see our new talk on the forbidden secret. There really is a secret, ladies and gentlemen. Been passed down for 5,000 years, and you can't understand anything going on today unless you understand that secret. You need to get our four-tape or CD set, The Secret Behind the Secret, the video, award-winning video, The Secret Mystery of America's Beginnings, or Riddles in Stone, another documentary, goes into the secret architect of our nation's capital, because everything being done today is being done in secret. The one thing they fear is the American people are going to wake up before it's too late, before they have established the age-old plan, 5,000 years old, of establishing a one-world government, a new world religion, and a new world leader. Well, remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. The reason, of course, they want to get us into a war with Iran is actually advance the police state controls over the lives of the American people, and a fear that the war with Iran will lead to World War III, and then they can have all the more control over us in the name of protecting us now from the wicked Iranians, and no longer the wicked Osama bin Laden. Now it'll be the wicked Ahmadinejad or the wicked Khatami, the supreme ruler of Iran. People don't understand that there is a cosmic plan. It is being enacted. You need, of course, to read my February 2007 newsletter. It's available up on the internet. If you don't have access, we can always send you a copy. The February 2007 letter tells you what the plan is. It's been laid out over decades ago by the writings of Alice Bailey. Well, she didn't really write them. Her writings were channeled to her by a demonic spirit. Yes, Alice Bailey wrote 19 books, all channeled to her by a demonic spirit. And we really are involved in a spiritual battle being fought today for the souls of men, the survival of Christian civilization. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Because America is at war. America is under attack today, not from without, but from within.